Thank you for joining us for another lesson from God's Word. The West Huntsville Church of Christ at Providence is located at 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Anytime you're in the Huntsville area, we hope you'll stop in and be part of our worship. Sunday morning worship is at 9 o'clock, with Bible class immediately following. Sunday evening worship is at 5. Midweek Bible study is held Wednesdays at 7.
Well, we're back at the maps again. You know, I was a Christian for several years before I really started paying attention to the maps that are at the end of the Bible. Many of us have those, not everyone, but I looked at them and I thought, very interesting, but it just didn't seem to make a lot of connection for me. So I just went on and read what I read and made sense as best I could. But we're talking about Israel. This is on the edge of the Mediterranean coast. And so we're moving along again. We're going back to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is where, obviously, things really started stirring. Started with David, actually. And as we look at this, I'm going to talk in a few minutes here about the Dome of the Rock once again. But as we're talking about Jerusalem, the very first part begins with David. This is 1,000 years before the time of Christ. And so there's a lower section, the southern section, that's called the House of David or the City of David. And it's not that big at all when you look at it, thinking of Jerusalem and how large you think Jerusalem ought to be. But that's where it starts. After David, you know, his son comes along, Solomon now, and he expands the temple. Remember that God did not allow David to build a temple that David wanted to do because he shed blood. But Solomon came along and now you get this addition where the Ark of the Covenant will eventually come. So it becomes called the Temple Mount. And the Temple Mount is quite extensive, much larger than what was originally there. And Israelites are obviously faring very well because of all the things that Solomon is able to do. He brought prosperity to Israel and so many different things. And I would suppose that as Cody mentioned this morning, how we're in a country that we are very blessed. And they very much were in their day and time, maybe more than we are now. We don't know exactly. But gold abounded and other things during that time of Solomon. Now, Temple Mount, let me back up just one shot here, is now under Islamic control. Islamic people are taking care of, are in power over this area where Solomon had built. And so when you go into this side of Old Jerusalem, you're looking at a little bit nicer area because they've built it up since that time, the 600s and 700s A.D., so we were allowed to take a tour through that area. Yes, this is where Solomon had built a lot of the nicer parts of Jerusalem. The Jewish people do not cross over that side. But if you follow certain codes and dress with the robes that they put on you and leave your Bible behind, we're not allowed to take our Bibles in with us into that area. They put them in a little cubicle and you can come back and pick it up later. And I remember with some of the people, some of the kids are looking at it, or younger ones, and saying, I don't want to leave my Bible here. What if somebody takes it? And somebody said, nobody's going to want your Bible here. They don't even want to touch it. And so so we go into this area and we begin to look around the Temple Mount, or the Islamic side of it. Very nice, very classy looking. And a lot of the columns that you're seeing here are not original as far as first century. But they date back a long, long time to the 600, 700, or 800 period as this is expanded and built up. Now you're thinking, why are we talking about that? We'll get there in just a few moments. The picture is crooked here because as I was taking it, I was intentionally not letting the people know out there in front that I was taking a picture of them. And if you can tell up under the tree there, there's a few guards and some police, etc. They're all around this whole area. When you think about what's going on today in the Middle East, They're expecting upheaval at any moment. There are always guards there protecting, because right on the other side of the wall are the Israelites. And they've been there, and they're planning someday to have all of this together. And they are in the storehouse of having a menorah and all the things that they once had in Israel to be able to come, move in and take over. And so with fear in mind, they have guards there constantly watching what's going on. But a beautiful area, phenomenal in what you're seeing in this area. And this is all part of what Solomon originally built. Lovely arches and all. And some of these, I'm sure, don't actually go back, not to the time of Solomon or even to the time of Israel when they had that. But some of it does. And I really don't recall what was said about the age of these arches. But you got to remember that the Islamic people did a lot of refurbishing and rebuilding during that area. And we talked a tiny bit last week about the Dome of the Rock. And I wanted to focus on that again today and carry it a little bit further. This is known, it's an octagonal Islamic shrine at the center of the Aqsa Mosque, is what they call it, on the Temple Mount of the old city of Jerusalem. It's the world's oldest surviving work of the Islamic architecture. The earliest architectural works were put together by the Muslim ruler. I can't begin to describe his name, but it was based upon what the Muhammad, their prophet, did. The initial construction was undertaken during the time of 691 to 692 AD. And it was built on top of what they call the foundation stone, or they describe as the noble rock. The site is significant for the Muslims, as it derives from their belief that that was the night the journey of Muhammad began from that rock to the center of the structure. So there's the Dome of the Rock. And you wonder how large it is. So we've got some dimensions put there in feet so we can grasp out a little bit more. So it's 200, the base part, 200 feet wide, 36 feet tall, not counting the dome. The Dome of the Rock is an octagonal Islamic piece. I've read some of that. Roughly 66 feet in diameter, the dome part. And the outer walls, we'd already mentioned the size of it. So it's a rather large monument. The reason for it, you skip down toward the bottom part of this, is it's believed to be that the rock, number one, that Abraham used as the altar where he was about to offer Isaac his son. Genesis 22, we know that. Whether the rock is, we're not sure. But inside this dome, there's a rock that's roughly 59 feet long, 26 feet wide. Now, in somewhere in that area, we know from Genesis 22 that the Lord commanded Abraham to offer his son. And as you read that section, it simply just astounds us that Abraham immediately followed God's commands. No hesitation, no doubts, always knowing, as we found at the very end of that section, that God provides. And incredible faith. Whether that is where the rock is or not, who knows? But that's what's believed by both sides, that's it. And obviously the Islamic people have their connection all the way back to Abraham too. So there's what it looks like when you get up close. Now here's where we get into some unusual things about Scripture tied into what went on in that area. First of all, during the time of David, you remember that Uzzah, one of the characters that was in charge of helping move the Ark of the Covenant, and instead of carrying it like they were supposed to, put it on a cart, it stumbled at a certain threshing floor. And when the ox stumbled, Uzzah reaches out and touches the ark, and God strikes him dead. Remember the story. And then immediately after that, David is angry with the Lord because he did that. Like, it wasn't Uzzah's fault that they did it. But as you come along a little later, David's convinced he needs to bring the ark back to Jerusalem, or the house of David, temple of David. So he responds back to the priest, what's mentioned in 1 Chronicles 15, 13 to 15. David's saying now to the priest, because you did not carry it out the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us because we did not seek him according to the rule. Notice what's mentioned here. So the priests and the Levites consecrated themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, and the Levites carried the ark of God on their shoulders with poles as Moses had commanded, according to the word of the Lord. It's interesting, when you get back to the basics, you do it right, and God is pleased. But the point I want to make particularly is now David is bringing the Ark of the Covenant back to the Jerusalem area. Moving along, 1 Chronicles 15, 29, and as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came to the city of David, that earlier region of Jerusalem as we know it today. Move along in 1 Chronicles 21, 15. And the Lord and God sent an angel of Jerusalem to destroy it. But as he was about to destroy it, the Lord saw and he relented from the calamity. And he said to the angel who was working destruction, "It's enough. Now stay your hand." And the angel of the Lord was standing. Notice where this threshing floor is. By the threshing floor of Onan, the Jebusite. So this is the location now where everything pauses. 1 Chronicles 21, 18. Now the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David that David should go up and raise up an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Onan, the Jebusite. Consecrating what's going on there at that threshing floor. Move in 2 Chronicles 3, verse 1. Then Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to David, his father, at the place that David had appointed on the threshing floor of Onan to Jebusite. So the Ark of the Covenant is coming in. The temple worship is being established on Mount Moriah. Now God bringing this all into view. So what we're looking at is basically 1,000 years before the time of Jesus. We go back to Temple Mount and we're looking at what was there 1,000 years ago, and we're seeing the Dome of the Rock is the same place that Solomon initiated the Temple Mount and began the worship there in Jerusalem. So as we're grabbing pictures of what actually is there, whether the Temple Mount looked like that, of course not, we're understanding that we're looking at the same place that the Israelite community became Israel in Jerusalem. Any questions about any of this? I hope not, because I'm not sure I could answer any of them. But it's just giving us a picture of what's going on. And the incredible thing is, it's always right there at the same spot. You know, I always thought, this was over here and over 100 or 1,000 miles over there. And it's the very same place we're reading about. That when David is there and the threshing floor is being consecrated and the ark is coming in, and then Solomon comes along with the Temple Mount 1,000 years later, they're still right in the same place. Gives you a little bit of understanding of why the Israelis are wanting to have that area, the Temple Mount. They believe it's always been theirs and should be. That's politics. We'll go on here. Now, last week, we looked a little bit on the other side, the Israeli side, was called the Eastern Gate. Mentioned from Matthew 21 that it's likely where Jesus made his triumphal entry in Jerusalem. We know that took place for sure from what Matthew records about Jesus entering Jerusalem. And all the praise and the worship and all. This is at toward the end, of course, of Jesus' ministry as he's coming into that. Now, that's from the exterior looking at the gate. And on the other side belongs to the Islamic people. This is the gate now in the background from the Islamic side looking at it. A little bit nicer looking at it. Again, the walls sealed off in this day and time began because nobody's wanting any kind of opportunity for anybody to come in and try to take over this possession. The eastern gate on the inside, when you look at it today, looks something like this. I wanted to read a passage from Acts chapter 3 because the eastern gate is also called the Golden Gate and it's called the Gate Beautiful. So Acts chapter 3, it says, "Now that Peter and John went up together to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour. And a certain man lame from his mother's womb was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful." So this is where he was. Now, it probably didn't look like that. The artist's rendition is this is probably what it really looked like during that time. And so you've got Peter and John going up to the temple, going through this gate or something that looks like that, more ornate than what we saw in this picture. But this is the gate where they walked in. There's where the man was begging at the Gate Beautiful, and Peter and John come up. The guy looks at them thinking he's going to get something, and it more than he ever could have imagined. And he's healed right there within that gate. So what takes place afterwards after they're coming in the gate in Acts chapter 3? The man's healed. Does he go away on his own? Is he told to go to the Pharisees and show himself to be cleansed? Or what happens to the man? As Peter and John are moving through the temple, ornate looking more like this, and in its luxury, and the man that was healed, who had been lame from birth, now is seen in a very glorious way also. Not only does he gain strength in his legs, but he gains mobility that some of us don't have today. That takes a long time for a little baby to grow into it. So look at it almost as a double miracle because of his ability to do all these things of jumping and leaping and also by being healed and having the power to do that all within this area. And they're going through the temple. So there's a great commotion going on, but I just wanted you to see from the pictures that they had the luxury and the glory that's going on within this temple at that time. Now, the high priest Caiaphas, as you look back to the beginning of Jesus here, and back just a short time before during that time when Jesus was alive, Matthew 26, starting at verse 47, describes the betrayal of Jesus by Judas, mentions the fact that Jesus then is taken away by guard. And you come down to verse 57, and it says, "And those who laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled." A couple things to note here. This is definitely Caiaphas' house. According to Matthew 26, 57, this is where Jesus was taken. When you're looking at the structure the way it exists today, 2,000 years later, there's a lot of first century steps that move up to it, up into Caiaphas's upper area there as you're looking at his porch. The columns and the road coming up to it are all first century stones. And who's brought there and led to that but Jesus? Now, let's take it one step further. As you're looking at this is now where Jesus was taken. Peter, as you recall, was following not real close behind, but keeping up with when Jesus was taken away. He and John are moving in close to this place where Jesus is taken. Verse 69 of chapter 26. 6 of Matthew. It says, Peter sat outside in the courtyard. Let's back up 1, 2. There's the courtyard. Back it up a little further and you can see the area. A servant girl came to him during this time and said, you're also with Jesus of Galilee. As you know, it says, but he denied it. Second time, and he denies it. A third time, and he denies it. At this location, Peter is denying the Lord. Same place. So what do Christians do in the second and the third century but build a shrine and a church building to honor Peter, who denied the Lord, of course, but on that location or that site? Some people came along in AD 333, questioned, and they were retold the same story. This is the site. This is where it took place. So what they did was they built the church called the Church of Peter, however you want to pronounce Galicantu. It's in Spanish, it's the rooster is crowing. Gallo is a rooster, and so it's singing out. So the church building is interesting. Build a little monument, if you can see it clearly here. It has a Roman soldier nearby, has Peter sitting down trying to deny Jesus and explain he doesn't know him. The girl asking a question, the younger girl who let him in behind that and up on top of the little pillar is the rooster crowing. That's the way things are done artistically. Under that church building is a dungeon. You go down the steps, go around a corner, and another set of steps, and you take down to the second level, and you look to the right as you get to that level, and I don't know if you can see it real clearly. It looks like there's a flat little can or whatever. That's about 3 feet wide, a canister, and right in front of it is a hole carved into the rock. Now you move from that level down to the next level and you look up and the hole goes all the way through that area. Now I'm going from memory when I say about 30 inches wide. Big enough for a person to be lowered inside. Hollowed out down below, and what they have below the Church of Peter now, they've discovered a dungeon set up for prisoners. When you look at Matthew 27, you know back at verse 57 of chapter 26 that Jesus was taken to Caiaphas' house. This location is where they have the Church of Peter on the steps of where Jesus was taken. Verse 1 of chapter 27, it says, and when morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. And when they bound him, they led him away. So Jesus spent the night somewhere near there. Caiaphas, the high priest, or the older high priest, has a younger son now who's high priest at that time, is in charge of this area, and underneath his dungeon is a place to put prisoners. The guy that led our excursion through all of the different parts of Israel, a lot of times we'd go to locations like this and others, and we'd ask, did this really happen here? What's your thinking, etc.? And he'd always respond with percentage. Well, it's probably 50% possibility or 80% possibility. This one's much higher. Not 100% possibility, but in all likelihood, this is where Jesus spent the night. So they lowered him through, as they would any prisoner, into this hole. And you think, well, why would they put Jesus there? Son of God. But for them, he is the worst criminal they could ever have. Where do you put your worst criminals? In the lowest parts of the dungeon. And this is what it looks like as you get down to the final part. There are some places, the photographs didn't turn out as well as I like to have. It is dark down there, even with the moderate lighting that they gave us. But there are nails, iron nails, heavy nails, driven into the rocks in strands of leather, as best I can recall, or something, where they would chain up their prisoners. Just didn't bring that one to show it to you because you couldn't see much anyway. But in all likelihood, this is where Jesus was. Now, when you turn over to Acts chapter 4, which was talked about a little bit in the sermon, as I recall this morning, where Peter and John were out. And verse 1, as Peter and John are going through the temple, chapter 3, and we talked about the man who was healed, etc., in that location. As they're speaking to the people, the chief priest, the captain of the temple, and the Sadducees came upon them. Now, if you've got a group of people that are coming upon you, it's not like they're politely saying, hey, would you come along with us? I get the feeling they came upon them. They pounced on them. Two men, the whole gang of people, angry and ready to do them in as they did Jesus. Upset that this story that's gone on about Jesus is still lasting, and even now that he's resurrected from the dead. And they're not wanting to believe any of this, many of them. So being greatly disturbed, it says in verse 2, that they taught the people and preached Jesus, the resurrection from the dead, they laid hands on them and they put them in custody until the next day. In all likelihood, because this is, if you jump down to verse 6, that this is where Annas, the high priest, Caiaphas, John, Alexander, the whole family's there. This is their location. This is their dungeon. It was good for Jesus, probably good enough for Peter and John, too. My percentage on guessing at it, for as much as I know in archaeology, is a little lower than it was for Jesus. But this is all likelihood where our apostles were during that time, too. Now, coming outside of any questions about Jerusalem here, we're going to come back to it some other time, but let's talk about the Jordan River for just a few moments. Back to our map, and you see the little blue squiggly line. It goes all the way up to the brown area toward the top, into where what's called Syria today, down through the Sea of Galilee, not a very large water area, and then through that and all the way down to then the Dead Sea. So it's not a very lengthy river, but it's an interesting one because Matthew chapter 3 is where John the Baptist was preaching. I don't know what your vision was of the Jordan River. I always pictured this lush, or this is during the dry season, but just huge, not quite as big as the Mississippi that I knew from growing up in St. Louis, but it was maybe like Tennessee River size because there was much water there. Well, there's much water there too, sufficient to immerse any quantity of people that might come. So this is where John the Baptist was, somewhere along this sector. Exactly. It does mention somewhat of a location beyond Bethany. Another Bethany is too on our maps here, but that's where the Jordan River is. And so you can get a little glance out of one sector of it. There are some wider areas. We crossed at one place. It looked a little cleaner, a little more lush than the one where we stopped at. But at this location, that they still have the handrail that John the Baptist held on to when he would go down into the water. Yeah, I'm joking. I'm glad you're laughing about it. But they do have that set up there because there's a large gallery that you can come to on the upper right-hand side, benches seated, and you can come and you can watch any individual or your special person come and be baptized. Or you can go all the way down the steps, as you see me pictured in the lower left-hand side, go down to the water. And so there were two people there that were going through a ritual of baptism while we were there, so we stopped and watched that, took some pictures, etc., and noticed that. beyond the two people dressed in black and white there, you'll see a little barrier across the, kind of in the middle of the water. That's not the deeper end and the shallow end. That's the Jordan side and the Israeli side. So the guy that was telling us on the tour, he said, if you want to go wade out there, it's really not that deep. He said, but don't go out near that barrier. He says, because there's guys up on the hill from the Jordan side that have guns aimed towards you if you move near that. So we just went to the edge of the water because that seemed good enough for us. Jordan River. There are people, my sister visited some time ago, scooped up a little bottle of water and tied it. This is from the Jordan River and whatever. Nothing holy about the water there, but it was interesting that there we were, where Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist, and etc. All right, let's go back to Jerusalem for just a moment. Three things that we want to look at. First of all, Warren's shaft, which sounds kind of strange. He was an archaeologist in the 1800s. Then the Gion Springs, which sounds like a good place to get a drink of water. It is, cold water. And Hezekiah's Tunnel. I know a few of you, who's traveled to Israel and knows what Hezekiah's Tunnel is? A few people, yes. An amazing place. Did you walk through it? You did. Was it scary when you first started out? She says, no, it was for me. So anyway, we'll get to that in a second. Let's start with Warren Shaft. 1800s, an archaeologist comes to an area and he's beginning to examine things. And through some exploration, I don't know that he did all the digging, but he discovers or helps make a shaft that moves down about 42 and a half feet deep to come down to this area that's more like a cave. And so he's doing some exploring in this area and he finds Hezekiah's Tunnel, as it's titled today. Now, 2 Kings 20. I'm just going to read you a little bit about the background of some of these things. Let's start with some information about Warren Shaft, then we'll come down to 2 Kings. Warren Shaft, 13 meters long, it attaches to the Gion Spring. It was the main source of water during the Bronze and Iron Ages in Jerusalem, discovered in 1867 by the British engineer Warren, Charles Warren. The narrow part, in the initial sense, was almost a vertical straight down the shaft that fed down to the Gion Spring. In a wider sense, when it moved out, it became a shaft that came through the area. But again, it's still of the Bronze Age era. Now, let's look at 2 Kings 20:20. As we're talking about Hezekiah and all the things that he did, it says, the rest of the deeds of Hezekiah and all his might, and how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So move down to 2 Chronicles. And again, it's kind of elaborating of all the great things that Hezekiah did. And it said, and Hezekiah had very great riches and honor and made himself treasures for silver and gold and precious stones, for spices and shields, etc., costly vessels, storehouses, etc. It goes on and talks about cattle and sheepfolds. Verse 29, and likely provided cities for himself and flocks and herds in abundance, for God had given him very great possessions. And then it's kind of the culmination of it all. This same Hezekiah closed the upper outlet of the waters of Gion and directed them down into the west side of the city of David, and Hezekiah prospered in all his works. Because of a fear of being overcome by the Assyrians, Hezekiah ordered that there be a cut through from the Gion Spring that would bring water into Jerusalem. Because if you want to overtake the enemy and they're inside the walls, all you do is starve them out, run out of food, run out of water, and they'll come out. So ahead of time, Hezekiah has this tunnel carved. Now, it is a third of a mile long. You see me pictured in there. The only light I had was my cell phone over the top of my head. And Melanie, just a short distance away, is taking a picture of me. As you're moving into Hezekiah's tunnel that God helped him build to help his people survive, You're stepping down, not in holy water necessarily, but it's a bit eerie. You see, I'm up here touching the top part of the tunnel. It's no more width than from elbow to elbow, and I'm not the biggest guy in the group that's going down into this tunnel. It was tight for a lot of us, and as you're stepping off the first couple steps and it's just pitch black inside, they do not put any lighting in there. It's a third of a mile long. The first thing you do is you step down and go, oh, there's cold water in here. Yes. Somebody asked me after I did all this and I was talking about it, was it water cold? It was spring water. For those of you that have been around spring water, it's not warm by any means. So you're stepping down and you're wondering, with it being pitch black, how deep is it? You've not heard a giant splash, and you know there are people that went in ahead of you, and I'm wondering, am I going to make it? Is Melanie going to, what's going on? How long is this little passageway? If you look real close, you can see that the water level came up to the bottom of my shirt. That was the deepest part. We got a little bit more shallow, and we got brave enough to turn around and take a picture. Now, because you're going through behind a group of people that have just entered, and you have a group of people that are going in, and some of them don't have flashlights, and they're moving through this tunnel area where a lot of people don't really fit very well because they're about twice as big as you and bigger around and a lot taller. They're all moving at a snail's pace, okay? So how long does it take you to walk a third of a mile? Not a whole lot if you're just out going down the street, but if you're going through Hezekiah's tunnel, it seemed like forever. Toward the last part of the little passageway, the water was only ankle high, so it wasn't too bad. But this is what Hezekiah did. Now, if you're looking at a map and studying, you can see how it kind of wound around. Interestingly, is when Hezekiah had this carved, they started at two ends, and they met together in the middle. And in the middle junction, they were a little bit off, so there's one section that's a lot taller as they're coming together to find where the other one is. How they pulled all that off in that day and time, I don't know. There's the inscription on the wall that Hezekiah had this tunnel built to bring the water from the Gihon Springs into the city of Jerusalem. Why do I know that? Because there's a sign right next to it that has English underneath it. This is, you're standing in the place called Shiloh approximately 2,700 years ago during the reign of King Hezekiah that he carved this tunnel out. God takes care of his people. God takes care of his people. So as you're exiting Hezekiah's tunnel, there were some kids out there playing in the water if we were coming out, but I wanted to get a picture of it before we left so that you can come up and down steps. I don't know where the steps actually originated. I don't think it was the very first part. But as you're exiting Hezekiah's tunnel, it empties into the Pool of Siloam. I already have the answer there. I was going to say, does anybody know what happened at the Pool of Siloam? John chapter 9. What did Jesus do for the blind man? Yes, he healed him. Starting out with mud from his saliva. Put on the man's eyes. And Jesus is, go wash, not just wherever, but in the Pool of Siloam. Those that have been there, what did the water or the area smell like? Fresh water? Fresh water. That's best I can. Fresh water running through a tunneled area, rock carved out. And it continually runs from that spring. In a cave, yes. Definitely in a cave. A very small one. Right. Somewhat stale? I don't know. I don't recall. Some things are more vivid than others in memory, but I don't recall. Oh, you're welcome. Any other questions? As we're looking at things, Hezekiah had no idea that he was building a waterway except to save God's people at that time. But the number of different uses that it was for the Israelites during that time. To have constant fresh water was an immense thing. Israel is a very dry land. Springs are extremely valuable. When they talk about a place like the area of Dan that we'll get to maybe someday here, and there was water there, it's where God's people stopped because there was water. We move here, we go there, we travel about. We don't ever think, is there going to be water in the next city? But as we look at a lot of our cities, except for those in the more obscure areas like Huntsville, a lot of the major cities are built on waterways. God providing wisdom and ability helped his people to survive, even carving through rock. And how they did that for a third of the mile, meeting on two ends, I'd say God must have been involved in that. But he never leaves his people out. And as Cody mentioned, it was Paul at the very beginning, that God didn't just wind up the clock and then let it go. He stays involved in our lives. 2,700 years ago seems pretty long to me when Hezekiah was starting that tunnel. But that's a blink of an eye in God's way of doing things. Preparing things all the way back so that you and I can have what we need to have. And what a blessing it is to be called children of God. Go wash in the pool of Siloam and you come away with sight. What a difference the man had as he was facing that very same day Pharisees who could not accept that Jesus healed him. So we're in a battle, like Hezekiah was seeing, like Jesus saw, and trying to convince the world that God still works and still plans and especially has a plan for us. Preachers have lots of favorite passages. You've probably heard any number of them say, this is one of my favorite passages. One of mine is Jeremiah 29:11. I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future. But it's not a hope that we can hold in our hands. It lasts a lot longer than this life. But God walks with us, blesses us, uses us every step of the way to accomplish things centuries later that eventually would impact this person and that person. We don't travel this life alone, but we travel an incredible one when we walk it with Jesus. Guess we'll stop right here. I know the first bell rung, so it's probably close to the second one ringing. Any questions at all? Thank you for your attention. I know a few of you said that you've enjoyed these. I hope that all of you do and that it helps give you a little bit more strength about what's going on in the Scriptures. Definitely God's Word. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this lesson from God's Word. If you would like to continue your study of New Testament Christianity, please send your name and address to World Bible School, West Huntsville Church of Christ, 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Or if you prefer, send your name and address by email to wbs@westhuntsville.org.